It's Jim Cramer here. You're listening to the opening bell of CNBC's Squawk on the Street. Don't miss a minute of the action.
Good Monday morning. Welcome to Squawk on the Street. I'm Carl Quintanilla with Jim Cramer, David Faber, live from separate locations on this Monday morning as we kick off another busy week of earnings and a jobs number on Friday. Dow futures down about 200, reflecting in some part Warren Buffett's comments over the weekend about not seeing anything attractive in stocks and the president's comments on China last night. Oil is slightly red despite some indications that gasoline demand actually ticked up this weekend, Jim, as some states continue to get that reopening process going.
Look, it does feel that there is a very self-confident, even if based on some situations, not that, let's say, positive, senses by governors that it's time. And I think that the president is so oriented toward its time. And the president is so adamant in his called shot that we'll have a vaccine by year end. I want to hear what Davis has to say about that. That there's an element of two different worlds here. There's the real world, which is influenced heavily by the president saying, listen, let's open it up and people want to do it. And then there's the stock world, which is heavily influenced by Warren Buffett, who says, look, I sold the airlines because that industry's fundamentally changed. The gulf between the financial world and the actual world, the biggest I've ever seen. Really kind of amazing. David?
Jim, I'll step in there. Sorry, Carl. Yeah, I mean, you know, we've been talking about that for weeks, the many phone calls that you or I will have with business leaders who are focused on maintaining their liquidity, who are focused on just being around to fight another day come the end of the year. The many CEOs who join us on air who constantly talk about their businesses not coming back to the levels they were prior to the virus for maybe two or even three years. Now, they may be under-promising with the hopes of over-delivering, certainly. But even if you discount that, there has been this disconnect, as you point out, Jim, for some time between what the economic landscape appears to potentially look like, although so much is uncertain, and what we've been seeing in terms of what the stock market's expecting.
Yeah, that's why I loved the interplay with Becky and Warren Buffett this weekend and his discussion, very candid discussion about the airlines. If the airlines have fundamentally changed, what that really says is, in Buffett's eyes, what that really says is there are a lot of industries that are fundamentally changed. I keep coming back to that moment. What was Gary Kelly said to us? Well, if there's nothing to go to, why should the airlines do well? Had he said, look, I have to stick by the airlines because there's going to be a recovery and they're the ones that are most oriented, I might have influenced my thinking. But I felt like he verified a lot of what Dave and I are hearing, which is that, guys, please, if you think that we're just going to come back, you've got it really wrong. And maybe they're doing some under-promising. But then you layer it on with the president, who is so, I believe, over-promising. And I'm not fake news. I'm just listening to every single CEO, with the exception of Moderna, that really believes in the drug industry that we can do vaccines at scale. So I feel like that Buffett's overview on airlines really does make me very concerned about the near term.
Yeah. And as a backdrop, of course, Buffett has a long history in having his thinking evolve when it comes to the airline business. U.S. Air back in the 90s left a rather sour taste in his mouth about that. He came around to them in the last 5 or 10 years, and he talked about what he called a mistake over the weekend. Take a listen.
The airline business, and I may be wrong, and I hope I'm wrong, but I think it changed in a very major way, and it's obviously changed in the fact that the four companies are each going to borrow, you know, perhaps an average of at least 10 or 12 billion each. Well, you have to pay that back out of earnings over some period of time. I mean, you're 10 or 12 billion dollars worse off if that happens, and of course, in some cases, they're having to sell stock or sell the right to buy a stock at these prices, and that takes away from the upside down. And I don't know whether 2 or 3 years from now that as many people will fly as many passenger miles as they did last year. They may and they may not. But the future is much less clear to me about how the business will turn out through absolutely no fault of the airlines themselves.
So I thought that was devastating. I mean, remember, Southwest Air was able to sell 70 million shares, I'm sorry, at $28.50. And United Airlines sold 39.35 at $26.50. So, I mean, those are critical levels. And the fact that he went on to say there's just no reason to own them, so what's the point of just selling some of them, made me say, I think that they very much are a microcosm of a big chunk of the U.S. economy, not the world economy in some cases, as he said. And I came away thinking the longer-term story of comeback is very much in play, and that's not a lot of analysts thinking. I mean, even this morning, only Dow Chemical and Bank of America talking about a longer-term decline. Most of the analysts are just trying to figure out whether it's going to be a V or a U still. I mean, that the discussion that Warren Buffett had indicates that it's, if anything, a very elongated U or an L. And I know those things are shorthand, and a lot of people at home might say, what are you talking about? He just gave you, what? How about this, no hope near term? Anybody agree with that?
Yeah,
that sounds pretty accurate to me.
Yeah. Jim, the administration, Larry Kudlow last week, of course, have been particularly positive on the prospects of a quicker recovery. But I haven't heard that from many business leaders at all. I mean, L's, U's, Nike swooshes. I don't know how you describe it, but that's sort of what we're hearing more often than anything else. Nobody really is talking about a V anymore, are they?
No, but I would say that there's a huge chunk of the S&P that is really chugging along because they're either taking share from industry groups. There was a really critical moment where Buffett talked about how bad the newspapers went away as an industry. Well, we know that that's great for Alphabet. We know that that's great for Facebook. We listen to all these drug companies and their quarters, and their quarters are extraordinary. And they've not even benefited from the idea that there are a lot of doctor's offices that have been closed that will now open. So there's plenty of stocks to choose from, but they certainly aren't in a large part of the S&P. And that's why I thought that question that Becky asked Warren about how much, whether he's still sticking by the S&P, Warren took it as being yes versus any fund that takes a percentage or whatever. But I think that just the S&P set up for it's more of an active index than people realize. And they add good companies. But in a pandemic, many of the companies that are in the S&P are just, they could cease to exist. I think that's fair enough to say.
So, Jim, when you assess sentiment this morning, is it about Buffett? Is it about wider delineation between a reopening and economic normalization? Or is it about the president's comments last night and just inflaming already existent fears of U.S.-China trade tensions?
I was all for taking on the Chinese when our economy was really robust. And I think the Chinese, the people, the Communist Party's bad actors, not the Chinese. I mean, there's like a billion people. They're not bad actors, and a lot of them love Americans. But I think it's really important to recognize that the president now seems to want to raise tariffs with 30 million people unemployed. So there we are. That is 1932. I mean, I was happy that we raised tariffs when the economy was humming. And I do believe that the Chinese, again, I don't know what happened exactly in Wuhan. Nobody knows. But I don't want to take them on right now. And I listen to the president. He's like, acts as if the economy is just doing great or that it's going to come right back. But we got to be careful. There are historical paradigms that are very bad when your economy's doing poorly and you raise tariffs. And I think that the history books have to be open. That's not fake news. That's history.
Right. Right. The fact is the Chinese economy is recovering, although it's not as clear the Chinese consumer is willing to spend. And we're sort of seeing that in some of the early numbers here in terms of regions and parts of the economy there. Well, now that it's much of it is reopened. But they are coming back more quickly, perhaps, than we will. And that's, yet something else that we'll be looking back at in terms of wondering about, I think, Jim, how quickly they were able to rebound versus how long it will take us to and the rest of the Western world to a certain extent. Although there seems to be no doubt that many companies are focused on their supply chains and trying to figure that out and perhaps changing it in a way that they even hadn't thought about during the during the height of the trade war with China.
Well, it is interesting to see how many companies have these really awful supply chains that are rooted through China. And I'm glad we're speaking to Marc Benioff, CEO of Salesforce, because so many products start in China where we're routed through China, and the president's saying, listen, get out of China. It's going to be hard. China really hooked us. Now, look, what are you going to do? Most of our companies are about making as much money as possible, and China was the cheapest producer. But when you think about it, you think, okay, Apple, that stock was doing very well until the president really went ballistic about China. And Pompeo's comments this weekend basically just say it is a vast international conspiracy by the Chinese against the rest of us. And I don't think it's a vast international conspiracy. I think the bats got too close in the wet markets. But if he wants to build a case to try to get it so people don't want to cooperate with the Chinese, again, that's going to cause a lot of problems with our companies. Look, I don't want to represent earnings per share versus patriotism, but we have to recognize that what was said this weekend was chilling.
Well, it's not just earnings per share, but, I mean, this Reuters report about the administration, quote, turbocharging initiatives to bring back supply chains. I mean, it's not just earnings. It's inflation, right? It's consumer prices. It's all the things that made us want to get supply out of China in the first place 30 years ago.
Well, there was a great question. The questions were really pretty good in the Lincoln Memorial live show. And there was a moment where someone asked about pills. And look, the pills, many of our pills, they're not made in India. They're made in China. And I think I wish sometimes the president were a little more, targeted, because that is a supply chain that they have really, really got our hooks. Their hooks in us. But I do think that over the weekend, I just said, OK, here it goes. This is escalating at a level that we didn't think was going to happen with 30 million people. And I know that the president hates to be criticized in any way, shape or form. But I do think that history says you have to wait till things are better.
All right, Jim, we got a lot to get to, guys, this morning. Got calls on Disney, Tesla, Conoco. Obviously, a lot of earnings coming our way over the next five sessions, and that jobs number on Friday as well. We'll take a break. Be back in a moment. It's been a busy weekend of commentary when it comes to a potential vaccine for the coronavirus. Oxford scientists said they hope to get some signals on efficacy by June. And then the president talked about it on Fox last night.
We think we're going to have a vaccine by the end of this year, and we're pushing very hard. You know, we're building supply lines now. We don't even have the final vaccine. Johnson & Johnson, if you look at Johnson & Johnson is doing it. We have many companies are, I think, close, because I meet with the heads of them, and I find it a very interesting subject because it's so important. But I think we'll have a vaccine by the end of the year.
It does echo, Jim, what you've said. That is that the commentary from these giants wouldn't be so positive if they weren't, in fact, close.
Right. Look, J&J is spending $250 million to build plants all over the world. I mean, they're doing everything right. I feel confident that they can conquer it. But it's the time frame. It's entirely possible that the president says we could have a vaccine, but is it scalable? It would be unbelievable time. I mean, the shortest time that we've ever been able to do a vaccine from start to finish was mumps, and that took 4 years. I remember polio took very, very long. And what I feel like is I think the drug companies are too optimistic, but I'm not a scientist. I just feel like there are so many that are trying, but that it's just, again, historically, it's never been able to be done. Now, maybe this is the time that they can just really speed things up because they have better technology. But I think it's important to point out that the president is raising expectations to a level that I hope are not too high. And I don't mean that to be critical. I'm just saying that the scientists themselves, and I spoke to the top people at J&J, they're very excited about getting something to us next year. But it's next year. And if you listen to the president, he makes you feel like football season is going to be on. And that would be great. So is the NFL. They make it feel like football season. There is just an unreal aspect. Maybe we're all just, enough people have gotten sick that we should all just accept the fact that we can play on and be tough as Americans. But I don't think it's that kind of situation. I think that we all kind of have to wait to go to the next level. And that the idea of the vaccine being ready is very different from whether it's scalable. That's the big question.
Right. And by the way, whether it's safe and effective, of course, becomes an even more important point as well, Jim. You know, again, the same. We rely on the experts. We rely on people who we believe at least are in the best position to understand these things. And certainly that would be the most optimistic forecast that I've heard, the idea that it could be as soon as the end of this year.
Right.
To your point, 12 to 18 months would be a miracle in and of itself,
yes, it
frankly,
would be.
Given the history of vaccines. Now, that said, we do have more people and more companies working on it with more advanced technology than it's ever put against anything in the history of something like this. So that's all good. But, you know,
sure.
What I come back to is what you hear time and again in terms of trying to get people back to normal behavior is more this idea of a regimen of antivirals, remdesivir at one side of it, if you actually unfortunately end up in the hospital, but a host of others perhaps that could be applied much earlier in the virus that would ameliorate significantly the effects of the virus itself and therefore just loosen everybody up in terms of their concern about it. You couple that, of course, with testing, which we're still not where we need to be,
right.
Nowhere close enough, at least in terms of testing, both the antibodies, both just being able to understand who's had it, who's got it, get immediate testing and contact tracing. And maybe if we get there by the fall, that's the thing that really gets us opened up.
Right. We're going to talk about that with Mark Benioff. Mark's kind of setting up an alternative state that sounds a lot like Taiwan or South Korea. We'll certainly talk about that. But I think that the going back to the vaccine for a second, without the vaccine, I doubt that we can return to normal life. And I think when will we know that it's effective? It's when everyone has had the vaccine. You have to think about something like smallpox, which just eradicated. There are a lot more questions about vaccine than there are antivirals. I did feel that, you know, if you go back to what Dr. Fauci said about that, you compare it to AZT, and a lot of professionals, including my doctor, Dr. LaPook, who's the CBS doctor, he shed a tear when he heard that because it said, listen, that's how the AIDS epidemic, the beginning of the end was AZT. But that's going to be a long time. If Dr. Fauci said he's confident about a vaccine at the end of the year, then I'm confident. I mean, that's really who we all listen to. He's just can't be owned. I think that's really important.
No, it's just Buffett's praise for Fauci over the weekend was remarkable, too. LaPook had a great piece on CBS about that AZT chapter in which he recalled every one of his patients dying when he was a very young doctor, heavily influenced by Fauci. But whether it's a vaccine, guys, or a therapeutic, as David says, regarding remdesivir, Daniel O'Day of Gilead did talk about the emergency youth authorization and the degree to which they can start getting it to patients as early as this week. Take a listen.
We intend to get that to patients in the early part of this next week, beginning to work with the government, which will determine which cities are most vulnerable and where the patients are that need this medicine. So we've donated the entire supply that we have within our supply chain. And we did that because we acknowledge and recognize the human suffering, the human need here, and want to make sure that nothing gets in the way of this getting to patients.
Well, we have to hope.
So that's
that,
a big deal.
Yes, very big. But, Carl, you know what? When Regeneron reports tomorrow, I want to hear that their monoclonal antibody could be a cocktail with what remdesivir is. Remdesivir alone is not proven to be able to, it's just proven to be able to get you out of the hospital earlier. I'm waiting for the big test, which just says it's not a death sentence if you get on the ventilator. And we haven't heard that yet.
All right, guys, we're going to get back to covering the markets, of course, which do appear poised to open lower, at least when trading begins about 9 minutes from now. Also got some key downgrades of the likes of Disney that we'll get to as well when Squawk on the Street comes right back.
Salesforce founder, chairman and CEO Mark Benioff has been setting a tone when it comes to America's response to the coronavirus pandemic. We'll talk to him exclusively. Jim has that later on this hour. Don't go away.
Welcome back to Squawk on the Street. Airlines going to be under pressure this morning after Warren Buffett, of course, of Berkshire Hathaway says, don't own them anymore. Jim, American Airlines is your mad dad.
Yeah, I just want to kind of flesh out some of the things that Buffett talked about so you don't just say, oh, Warren Buffett says sell, sell. And he wasn't saying that. He's just saying it's a changed industry. And Barclays has a report out today which downgrades American from hold to sell. They had been using a $20 price target. Now they've gone down to $7. But one of the things that I know, David, you follow these very closely, pension liabilities. Talking about gigantic pension liabilities, $6 billion at American. You know, I thought this industry had started to look up. And then I see that kind of liability, plus obviously what they're borrowing from the government. And I say, yeah, Warren Buffett's right. It's the balance sheet. It's not so much the fact that travel's really been crushed, but the balance sheets have fundamentally been changed. So you've got a double-edged sword. You've got very little demand, and you have the balance sheets just ballooning. So, yeah, I mean, I could see this stock going to 7 in a heartbeat.
Yeah, I mean, you know, right now, as we've said, Jim, so many companies are focused on preserving and maintaining their liquidity,
right,
making sure they have adequate access to capital when they need it to run their business. Eventually, some of them will get to, and some already are, getting to solvency. That's a different aspect of the crisis.
Yeah, Bob Crandall, my voice love, American, he talked about how the industry's not investable. He talked about how it should be utility. And I found myself thinking, American, these stocks had been so great at one point after Obama let them consolidate. Those days are over. And what you're really looking at is questions by, you ask people, Brian Sullivan asked a money manager, when would you fly? I mean, I debated flying with my wife this weekend, of course, in a socially distant fashion. And we talked about how Emirates is going to require a blood test or some sort of test before you get on the plane. And I like that idea, but it's also not that practical for all these different companies to do some sort of Abbott Labs test walking in. It may be just kind of unrealistic.
Yeah. On that note, Jim, as you're speaking about aviation broadly, I should mention Dow Jones reporting that GE Aviation has expanded its job cuts now to cover 25% of its global workforce. They had been, I believe, at what was 10%. This is according to a memo that Dow Jones is citing. Of course, Larry Culp joined us last week, and not sugarcoating either the outlook, at least when it came to aviation, such an important part of GE's business.
No, I have the memo, yeah. I mean, the article is right. I again, it's chilling because GE is so challenged on so many fronts, exception of healthcare. You can't get you can't right size these businesses. They're gigantic and they were built for tremendous multi-year growth. So it's very hard to figure out what the right level table of employment you have to have. And the analysts aren't, I think, they're not forgiving enough to a guy like Larry Culp who's doing his best. They're just kind of looking at it and saying, well, you know, you got nothing cooking there.
Yeah. We all had the, sorry, I had it in my inbox. I hadn't looked as well.
Don't worry.
That opening
about it,
bell, Carl.
You covered it well.
Yeah. At the big board, guys, it's Eric Millen, NYSE facility supervisor at the NASDAQ, ringing the bell remotely. It's Youth Inc., a network of nonprofits helping young people in New York City. Other big, we're going to get a lot of earnings this week, Jim, but Tyson was one of the big ones of the morning. Now some other headlines crossing regarding what we all want to know about, and that is hog processing capacity in this country. They say it's been cut in half as the virus closes slaughterhouses. You're seeing some infection rates, Jim, in some of these towns with slaughter or processing facilities that rival even large cities in states like Maryland.
Upton Sinclair wrote a fabulous book called The Jungle, The Turn of the Century. He talked about how immigrants were put in meat factories and really just treated as if, let's just say, with absolutely no health care concerns at all. Is that happening here at Tyson? I think Tyson has a lot to answer for here. This is the kind of thing that if we had an Upton Sinclair, I think he might go to these places. I don't know what these places are like, but these sound very much like what Upton Sinclair exposed at the turn of the century. And someone should be ashamed here, I think.
Yeah.
And it's not the workers.
It's largely about beef and pork.
Yeah.
Yeah. Largely about beef and pork because of the need for human hands to debone. It's not like chicken where it can be more mechanically done. They did miss. Revenue was light. They did secure an additional $1.5 billion loan facility, Jim, which I guess is sort of almost automatic on some of these big earning prints this quarter.
But should that many people be getting sick? I mean, I know that the supply chain is really important, but I do believe that at a certain point, Ethan Brown reports this week, Ethan Brown being, of course, Beyond Meat. And I'm wondering, and I know David's going to be somewhat skeptical because plant-based is kind of pie in the sky right now. But is that where we have to go? Because this Tyson thing, let's just call it what it is. It's an abomination. Who are these poor people who work at these plants? I bet it's going to turn out it's the same people who worked in terms of their socioeconomic level that happened in the 1900s when Upton Sinclair wrote The Jungle. I think these people are poorly represented. I think that they're treated as if they are, I don't know what kind of health care they're doing. But where's OSHA? Has anyone seen OSHA? I mean, wasn't OSHA supposed to help people? I don't know. I mean, if we don't call them out, who will? Don't we have to call them out? It really is just kind of shattering.
You want to go through a list of government agencies that are MIA? Where's the CDC? How about them? Remember them?
Well, the SEC, Jim, when it comes to Tyson, is coming back in the fall.
Yeah. When it comes to Tyson, one would have expected this actually would be a strong period for the company in many ways. Demand for their products certainly is through the roof. And yet, as you point out, they have not been able to capitalize at all and, in fact, having a lot of missteps.
Well, my Chapel Trust owns it, and I'm ashamed that I even own it. I bought it for all the reasons you just said, which is that I thought that this would be their time. Now I just want some enterprising journalists to go outside their plants, find out what the heck is going on there. I think they have a lot to answer for. And maybe they'll say, well, listen, no, we don't. We're doing exactly what the government says. And that's usually the answer these days, right? Hey, the government. Well, I guess so. But we need this to go back to the Upton Sinclair days where we looked at into these situations. I'd like Tyson to come on. Maybe they've got a good maybe it's like Carnival where there's a perfectly innocent, excuse that, well, they're like Arnold Donald. I spoke with them last week. I mean, look, we followed the rules. I mean, maybe Tyson's following the rules. Maybe it's the rules should be changed. And Tyson's a good actor. Hard for me to believe. But I'm Jimmy Chill. I can understand it.
Well, you mentioned Carnival, Jim. I'm sure you see these crossing now. Plans to phase in North American service August 1.
Well, you get some bargains there. Tough piece in GQ coming out soon. People want to cruise. They do. And maybe they cruise in a way that is socially distant, and cruises are a bargain. I'm not going to rail against anyone who wants to take a cruise, provided that they are doing the same things that they do on airlines or whatever. I mean, I just think, look, the government hasn't said no, and who am I to say you can't cruise? I don't know. I just don't feel like, people want to cruise. When you speak to Carnival, their business is pretty, next year's business looks good.
Yeah. Speaking of travel and leisure and things that people plan for and are around life events, of course, going to a Disney park, guys, is certainly one of them. Thankfully, we've done plenty of it, thankfully, with our kids. This morning, certainly a lot of talk around this Moffitt-Nathanson downgrade of Disney, citing what they're calling a long and winding road. They have the stock now in neutral. No real surprises here in a sense. We've talked about the challenges Disney, of course, will face in terms of the theme parks, not to mention as well the ESPN network, the lack of sports, lack of advertising, the studio being shut down right now in terms of production. Disney Plus obviously been the bright spot, certainly. But the numbers that they put out there at Moffitt-Nathanson, Jim, are pretty stunning when you look at total revenues, what they're expecting now. And again, they're low on the street now, but they just think things are going to take longer to come back. I guess that's the easiest way to sort of discuss it. $26.2 billion in fiscal year 19 revenues. This year is seen at $17.6 billion, $17.5 in fiscal year 21, and $21.3 in fiscal year 22. I mean, that just gives you a sense there in terms of the reductions. Now, fiscal year 22 is going to be a huge increase over 21. So that'll be your inflection year. But you might want to wait if you see that coming to buy the stock.
I mean, I read this, and it's Michael Nathanson, always does high quality work. And it starts off by saying, listen, we've recommended it for a decade. And the piece is, it is kind of, again, what Warren Buffett said. The airlines are really well managed. It's just that they can't, in this environment, do well. And talk about how I missed Trump. When I read this piece, David, I said, let me think. Is there a way to make it so you could open those theme parks? And Becky Quick talked about this morning, too. And I can't come up with a way. I mean, you have to disinfect constantly, and lines are bad. And the great thing about Disney is that they handle the crowds well. Well, but you can't really have crowds. I don't know. Right. I thought this was a no way out, a very good downgrade. very well thought out. And I don't have answers for if I'm Iger, I say, well, I don't see anything wrong with this report. I just like to be a little more optimistic with the same set of facts.
Yeah, I mean, the obviously they have furloughed most of their employees at the parks. So you could bring back the employees commensurate with the number of visitors to a certain extent. But then again, people expect, you know, the parks to be pristine, which they always are in terms of cleanliness and so many other things. So it does raise a lot of questions about staffing and costs versus how many people will actually be walking through the front gates and when that will really return. And then you get to the sports, to the networks as well, media networks.
Yeah.
And listen, we've been talking about that for our own parent company as well, which the Wall Street Journal reported there may be some layoffs at NBC Universal and the likes. But sports is obviously a key component of Disney in terms of ESPN. We know what's going on there. No sports are being played. The question becomes, when are the cable distributors going to start to say, hey, why are we paying for this? Why are our customers paying for this? And I've been hearing maybe not until July when we really get some clarity. You know, maybe come July, we know whether we're going to have a football season. We know whether we're having a baseball season. We know whether they're going to be NBA playoffs or when they'll be or not college football. And so that mm-hmm. may be the key point at which you really start to see not just the disconnects, but the distributors saying, come on, force majeure, let's make, you know, you got to make good on this, which will be another hit for those companies that have significant sports networks.
Aren't you surprised that hasn't happened, David? I mean, baseball's on. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, I've been hearing that, you know, that it's a conversation, and yet I haven't really, I've been talking to the senior managers at some of the large media companies, and it doesn't appear that it's come to the point yet where the distributors are saying, we're not going to pay you.
Right.
It does seem as though they're pushing it a little bit, Jim. But you're right. I would have expected it to a certain extent, given they're expensive, as we all know. Not to mention the RSNs. Remember those? Now owned by Sinclair in a separate vehicle. But those are expensive, too. All of this, and none of it obviously having any real live sports. Then you get back to the teams and whether they're going to be liable. And then the team owners, who are also in a position now where they've always been taking money out of their teams. Now they've got to start to put money in. Essentially, it's a negative carry for the partners of all these teams. There's a lot going on in the sports world that's certainly worthy of paying some attention to.
I wish there were more public companies that people were. This Davidson piece addresses it head on and tries to put some numbers on it. But, yeah, I think you're right. I mean, Carl, we know that sports programming is the programming that keeps the networks getting new people in and advertising. We haven't even gone into the idea that people don't know how to advertise anymore if there's no sports, because sports is what you launch things
yep.
with.
Yeah, I was looking at some of the protocols the Koreans are putting into place for their baseball season. I mean, if there's one positive test reportedly, the league shuts down for 3 weeks. So hypersensitivity to any individual player falling ill. That said, guys, in the next 6 weeks, we're going to get NASCAR. We're going to get wrestling to some degree, we think, golf in June. Right. So sports in which social distancing is somewhat possible are going to start to get some airplay.
Well, I know that we're all crazed for live sports, as we saw from the draft. But football's the litmus test for me because there's just so much on the line for football and because it's so expensive. And we need to know the NFL is just deeply committed to a regular season. When a lot of people keep thinking it's going to be fanless and it's not going to start until on time, the NFL gives you kind of like a perspective of like the president. You know, don't worry about it. I don't know.
Jim, we're down 350. Only Microsoft in the green on the Dow, just barely. Let's get to Rick Santelli on this Monday. Hi, Rick.
Good morning, Carl. You know, as equities start to get a bit tired, but they had a nice big move from the lows. Obviously, April was a good month, but May's different. However, treasuries, kind of the same still. We're up a little bit in the long end, basically down a bit in yield in the short end. That's been the way lately. And if you look at a two-week chart of 10-year note yields, here's what I really want you to pay attention to. When markets start to give you tells of where they like to trade, where they're comfortable, you make note, and you really make note when they move out of their comfort range. This two-week chart, 60 to 62 basis points pretty much trades every single session. So we want to watch those high-frequency areas as we move away from them or remain inside them. And if you look at the HYG, the high-yield ETF that the Federal Reserve said, hey, I think we may buy that someday. Well, everybody flocked there. They haven't really gone there yet. There's a lot of debate as to whether they're going to go there at all, meaning the central bank, the Fed. But look at the right side of that. Now, that's obviously a February 1st chart. We had a lot of volatility February, March. But look at how sideways it is on the right-hand side. It's also been comfortable, and we know that we'd rather have that going higher rather than lower. That most likely would be a risk on. It'll be good for stocks. And if we look at what's going on with the dollar index, same notion. Now, we know anything near 100 is powerful over the macro view. But lately, you know, as it dips towards 99, we think, it's coming off a bit. It was almost up to 103 not that many weeks ago. But also from a February 1st perspective, 99 to 100 is their comfort zone. And it may remain there. You want to be on guard for the euro strength, which could push down the dollar index. It's 57% of the dollar index. And there's many notions that a shared debt is got to be coming to the European Union. And ECB and Christine Lagarde have to work towards that end. And if that is ever going to come, it will be very bullish for the euro, very bearish for the dollar, at least in the immediate short term once it becomes implemented. And finally, our last chart, this is bonds. Now, you remember 2 weeks of 10 years was pretty much sideways. Not so with the bond yields. Now, obviously, they were closed on May Day, Friday, but there is a deterioration there. They're moving lower there, and much of that is the ECB needs that shared debt because they really can't implement the type of programs that the Federal Reserve has implemented here. Carl, Jim, David, back to you.
All right, Rick. Thanks a lot. Rick Santelli. Jim, we're being led lower by travel names off of the comments from Buffett over the weekend. But for all the, I guess, net negative things Buffett said, he did leave us on Saturday with some of that traditional Buffett optimism when it came to America at large. Here's what he said.
And we found that nothing can stop America when you get right down to it. And it's been true all along. It may have been interrupted with the scariest of scenarios when you had a war with one group of states fighting another group of states. And it may have been tested again in the Great Depression, and it may be tested now to some degree. But in the end, the answer is never bet against America.
All right, Jim, how do we put that to work meaningfully?
When you start comparing things to the war between the states or the Civil War, what that says is, you know, buckle your seatbelt. I mean, you know, 500,000 people, some say 600,000 people were killed. I know we addressed that, and, you know, that's not an investable situation. No, the Union won the war. But the idea that that was in vote sent chills, you know, down my back. Now, the Depression, yes. I mean, the fact that the Depression is less of a, well, the comparisons between the two. Well, the Depression is not as bad as the Civil War. I mean, you know, the Republic both times was in question. The Republic clearly in question during the Civil War because it was split. But the Republic also, if you look at the politics of the time, the center might not hold. It did hold. When he compares it to those two, what I say to myself is, no wonder he didn't buy when the S&P cratered on March 23rd. I mean, he didn't buy. He sold. So let's say your money where your mouth is. I mean, he obviously didn't think that this was the level. And if it's a Civil War comparison, obviously, you know, you're talking about Dow down substantially. So, look, there wasn't anything, you know, America will win. Yeah, well, I mean, like, you know, in 1863, we had a real solid look that Lincoln was going to prevail. I don't know. I mean, that's why there's like this big monument, although it turned out to be a beautiful stage. you know, remember, go back and read some of those speeches. I mean, the Republic was in peril. I mean, I hope it's not like that. I mean, we started 1864, yeah, no, some of those tide had turned.
Ooh. Yeah, some of those speeches are pretty well known.
Yeah.
On that note, Jim, let's get to Bob Pisani and get a market look this morning. Hey, Bob.
Everybody, happy Monday. At 2,800 on the S&P. Remember, we were at 2,939 just a short while ago. So we're 5% off of the recent highs. I watched Mr. Buffett's comments. I was surprised he didn't have any bargains out there. He wasn't doing a lot of buying at all. You can take a look at the sectors. You see his impact on the airline sector as he got out of airlines, essentially. Jets is the big ETF there. That's down notably. Energy's weak. Banks, retail. All these had great rallies in the last early part of last week. They're the ones declining now. Utilities was the only thing in the green at the open, and even that's in the red right now. Now the hard part starts. That's what I call it for May. It's traditionally a weak month, and no, the rules of investing have not been completely repealed, so it does matter. Remember what's driving the rally. We're only 17% off of the highs right now. The risks and things that are out there, we had massive fiscal monetary stimulus, hopes for a treatment of a vaccine, and reopening hopes here. And those are sort of the risks that we're seeing right now. I think the risks are very clear. We talked about them on Friday, that the reopening would go a little bit slower than expected. We saw talk over the weekend of long-term closures now of, in California. Maybe 50% of the restaurants might not be able to stay in business, even if there is a reopening. So the risks that are out there, if you put up the next full screen, are quite real. Further downward earnings revisions, I think, are very real at this point. The market's comfortable with a 25% decline in earnings for 2020, but not 35%, not 40%. We don't know if that's going to happen or not, and that's a very real risk right now. And, of course, there's some issue about whether or not the fiscal stimulus is going to keep coming there. We've heard discussions about big cracks there over how much aid there should be to states and local governments. Finally, also China tariffs. It's tough to get your handle around stock valuations and what we should be doing in May because of the lack of guidance. So look at today. Let's just update where we are on the guidance situation. 114 companies have suspended guidance. That's 25% of the S&P 500's got no long-term guidance, and we're only 60% through earnings season. That number's going to grow. 79 have suspended their buybacks, and 31 have suspended or cut their dividends. That's mostly in the consumer discretionary and energy space. This makes it really tough to figure out the right valuations and why we're still getting 400 or 500 point moves in the Dow on a daily basis. And of course, we still get companies withdrawing guidance. Remember, it's happening as I update this list every single day. Today, Air Canada, GATX, one of the big transport companies, National Retail, that's one of the big REITs. They also withdrew the guidance. Going to be tough figuring out the valuations in May. Carl, back to you.
That's for sure. Thanks, Bob. We're going to take a break here in just a couple of moments. Kramer with Benioff on Reopening America. Don't go anywhere. Can 2800 hold here as the S&P heat map shows a sea of red? Travel-related names getting hurt after Buffett's comments this weekend. And in just a couple of minutes, Benioff with Jim. Don't go away. Let's get to Jim and stop trading.
You know, Goldman wants you to buy the oils again. And the way they're doing it is to say that quality is on sale, and they're highlighting ConocoPhillips, adding to the conviction buy list. They do downgrade Chevron, but only because of how great the performance is from conviction buy to buy. You know, the Goldman stuff is very interesting because you have to try to figure out, have the oils gotten down enough? Is it the bottom or not? And I know that Mike Wirth, who's the terrific CEO at Chevron, said it's the bottom. I'm much more circumspect just because I want to see demand and I'd like to see supply ratchet back. Now, Rusty Brazil from RBN does talk about how there's finally going to be about 1 million barrels coming off per day in the U.S. But we're still not seeing the decline because it's so hard to shut down a well. There's so many different factors involved, including transportation agreements to be able to ship. But if you like oils, you got ConocoPhillips. Goldman loves it.
Yeah, Jim. Gas Buddy said demand on Saturday was up 1.6, right, taking you back to mid-March as people are obviously driving around. It's a little bit warmer. I mean, do you not believe, at least on distillates, we're seeing a bottom in the month of May?
I do. And I think that that's why I mentioned it. I feel that I don't really like the group at all, but I do think that if you did like the group, it's had a very big move off the bottom, really big. So now you got to be very selective because the market, the oil market really anticipated this. Remember, the oil stock started going up the same day that oil went to minus 37. And I do believe that minus 37 was a complete anomaly. And now I feel that, you know what, this Goldman wants you to buy them. But you got to be very careful because the bounce has been just incredible. And don't get carried away.
Yeah. The other thing we didn't get to, Jim, were Elon Musk's tweets from Friday. And then Adam Jonas today, taking it from 440 to 680. maybe ex-Ferrari, the most profitable, fastest-growing OEM that they cover.
Well, but I was thinking about it. I know that, there are some people who show you that after it was kind of like irrational exuberance in, Greenspan, where the, Greenspan did not necessarily do the right call. I go over what I think that Elon is being very let's say, critical of, what where they are. I mean, I think he wants to have Germany fly anyone. Remember, he was very upset about what happened in California. And so, therefore, he would think that if, the fascists, so to speak, as he said, don't change the way, then maybe Tesla is expensive. I come back and think, wow, can you imagine you have a football season and Ford and GM, they spend all that money on advertising, and Tesla doesn't need to advertise because of word of mouth. That has always been, to me, the strongest reason why I like Tesla so much. I really like it. Sorry, Elon. I think that you're going to get your way in California eventually.
Yeah. Well, I mean, his tweets were also interesting for any number of other reasons, including his decision to potentially sell what almost all his worldly possessions. Although he wants to be careful with Gene Wilder's house. That's what he owns, right? You got to make sure you sell it to the right person. Fascinating.
I love
to
Gene
read
Wilder.
Those tweets.
Wasn't Gene Wilder great?
Yeah.
I thought Frankenstein
was this. Yeah, yes, Young Frankenstein was a great one. Blazing Saddles.
Oh, my God.
Willy Wonka.
But
yeah.
Look, I think
guys,
he took Tesla down to a hold, right? He went from buy to hold.
We've talked a lot this morning about aviation for obvious reasons, given Buffett's comments and, everything else. We also mentioned briefly GE and that memo that was sent out by Vice Chair and President and CEO of GE Aviation, David Joyce. It was issued earlier today, telling the employees that they're developing a plan for permanent reductions to their global employee base that they anticipate will bring total reductions this year to as much as 25%. And we spoke last week, of course, with Larry Culp about the situation in aviation. He pulled no punches in describing how difficult things are.
The first and most important step we take as a company in the face of this pandemic to make sure we come out on the other side a better, stronger GE is to embrace the reality of what we're seeing. And clearly the pressure is going to be no greater in the short term and maybe over the medium term for us than it will be in aviation, given the airlines are trying to conserve cash, parking planes, bringing flight schedules down, postponing, in some cases, orders of, new planes. That hits us.
Yeah, I mean, no shortage of challenges there, of course. For companies that were, you know, again, in GE, Jim, we spent a lot of time talking about the remaking of the company that had been underway under the leadership of Mr. Culp and the fact that they were starting to see some momentum. And then, well, like so many other companies, completely out of their hands, the things that they're now dealing with.
But they do have $47 billion. Remember, they did raise the cash. They're going to be using a lot of cash. Healthcare is good. But no, it is, like Buffett said, you know, this is this event that people didn't insure against. And look, I think that Larry's going to come out okay, Larry Culp, but I do think that this industry is not a 2021 story. It just can't be. Too soon.
Yeah. Well, watch that one. That's a big story today for us, guys. It is 10 o'clock. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Squawk on the Street. I'm Carl Quintanilla with Jim Cramer, David Faber, Sarah Eisen, coming to you live from various locations. As we start the week in the red, it's going to be a busy one. In fact, we're getting factory orders right now. Let's get to Rick Santelli. Rick?
Yes, Carl, we're going to have a date with history on both these numbers. On our March read on factory orders, down 10.3. This series started in March of 56, the lowest ever month-over-month negative change was August of 2014 at minus 9.7, so we beat that, minus 10.3. And if we take ex-transportation, that's down 3.7. Durable goods orders, now they started in February of 92 in their current rendition. The smallest number month-over-month was minus 14.4. We beat that, minus 14.7, another date with history. And, of course, if we look at the internals, ex-transportation down 4/10. And if we look at capital orders, non-defense ex-aircraft, a proxy for capital spending, it's down 1/10. Nothing to brag about. My guess is that's going to get much worse as time goes by. That these are March finals, which also means that minus 14.4 gets removed. That was a mid-March. That gets replaced with minus 14.7. And if we look at orders, it switched to shipments. Shipments are down 0.2. My guess is that also is going to fare much worse over time. So both these numbers series are the biggest month-over-month negative change we've ever seen. Should be no surprise. The response in the marketplace, very counterintuitive. 10-year note yields go up a basis point. So obviously markets had these data points factored in. Jim. Back to you.
Thank you so much, Rick. And thank you for all the stuff you do that explains this stuff to us. All right, joining me now, Salesforce founder, chairman, and CEO Mark Benioff with an incredibly important initiative. I think that this is one called Work.com that is, to me, what if I were running a company, I would be sorely in need of because it puts it all in perspective for your company. Mark, welcome and tell us about Work.com.
Well, Jim, thank you so much. I'm delighted to be with you this morning. You know, Jim, we've had so many conversations now, and our hearts remain with everyone who's gone through this, traumatic situation with the virus over the last several months. And, you know, as this has unfolded for us, what we've seen is three phases. We've talked about that actually on your show. This first crisis phase that we're in, it's really this 90-day phase when we've gotten everyone in our homes and we've, taken shelter. That's when Salesforce actually has now purchased over 60 million pieces of PPE and distributed it to several hundred hospitals all over the world to help, bolster our defenses against the virus. But Jim, during this crisis, we've learned something very important, which is that as we move into phase two, the virus is going to still be with us, but we're going to reopen. So how are we going to reopen safely? That is what's been on our mind at Salesforce. And so that's why today we're introducing a new product line to help our customers reopen safely called Work.com. And we think this is going to be a critical part of allowing our customers to get back to work and do it safely.
Now, when I look at Work.com, one of the things that strikes me is, besides the command center, that like it's a process. There's a procedure. We've lacked. Company after company is very anecdotal about what to do. And one of the things that I think is really incredible is that if you were able to get public health involved with, say, what Google app were doing, contact tracing, which is available, then we would actually know as employees who's sick. Or without any privacy invaded, you were the first person in your emergency response management section that really makes me feel like, you know what, we could be Taiwan. I mean, Taiwan being the single greatest country on earth when it comes to this. You have a little Taiwan going among the people who are in Work.com. Do I read that correctly?
Well, Jim, when we go back to work, there's things that we're going to have to do differently. And those things include bringing PPE not just to our hospitals, but into our workspace. That's why we're talking about having masks in the workplace, for example, things that we can do to reduce the spread of the virus in the workplace. Because when we get back to work, the virus is going to still be there, but we want to mitigate our relationship with the virus. So PPE will be important. And of course, we're going to have to maintain social distancing. That will also be extremely important in the workplace. That's going to be a critical part of getting back to work. And of course, we'll be checking fevers, before employees show up at the office. But we will also use information technology in a smart way to mitigate the virus. That is, we can do things to help people be safer at the office. An example is very much what you just said. We knew that the person that you were sitting next to yesterday called in today and they were tested positive for the virus. And when we talked to them, they said they met you, this employee, that employee, the other employee, and we're calling all of those employees back. That's contact tracing. The idea that we can talk to and inform and manage the relationships that we have with those who may have been affected. And of course, like you said, those employees will have to be self-quarantined.
I think that one to try to get the accessibility here of a key part of your plan, new resources. You've got Dr. David Agus, who might know, is just sensational. Dr. Scott Gottlieb is on our network all the time. And then Dr. Larry Brilliant. I know it always sounds silly, but who's truly brilliant. Now, how will you be able to access those if you're a good client of Salesforce, or is that going to be videos and really just no one-on-one?
That's already live today, Jim, on Work.com. We are capturing the best advice, the best words from those doctors, like you mentioned, David Agus, Larry Brilliant, Scott Gottlieb, but also tremendous business organizations like the Business Roundtable, and others who are telling and informing businesses, here's a safe way that you can reopen. You know, those important elements of our community are critical. And we want to bring everyone together in a place where they can talk and share this critical information as well. So they will have a community, they will have apps, and they will have advisors. And we hope that the combination of these three things in work.com will give the ability for our customers to reopen safely.
All right. One last question. I know you're on a council that the president set up. He mentioned your name. Will you share this with the president? Because a lot of these things could be done by our country, and they would be very valuable if everyone plays.
Well, I think it's this is something that every company is going to need who wants to be able to have a great relationship with their employees and their customers. You know, we know that we're going to have to create these kind of new tools, next generation capabilities, but this is the beginning of a journey. There's no finish line, Jim, when it comes with battling down this virus. And I think that work.com is kind of going to be a very critical part of entering phase two, which is what I see happening, you know, over the next couple of months.
All right. Thank you so much, Mark. And good to get those at 1 a.m. this morning. I'm always happy to get woken up by you.
Thank you, Jim.
Very good. If it's valuable, and it always is. Mark Benioff is the CEO of Salesforce. Carl, back to you.
Great to see you.
Jim, that was good stuff. And I guess we're going to see more on Mad tonight, right?
Yeah, I can't wait to talk to Mark. I got some sleep after Mark woke me. I got 45 minutes. It was fantastic. You've been listening to the opening bell on CNBC's Squawk on the Street.